From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Full moon open lines at the half and next hour. Hired soldiers, contractors who kill for cash with Robert Young Pelton. Well, ABC's upcoming five-hour docudrama, The Path to 9/11, is quickly becoming a political football. The network has in recent days made changes to the film, set to air Sunday and Monday, after leading political figures, many of them Democrats, complained about bias and alleged inaccuracies. Meanwhile, an organization has launched a letter-writing campaign urging the network to correct or dump the miniseries, while conservative blogs have launched a vigorous defense. The Path to 9/11, whose large ensemble includes Harvey Keitel and Patricia Heaton, offers a sweep of the events leading up to the terrorist attacks of 9/11-2001. The movie dramatizes what it deems intelligence and operational failures of the Clinton and Bush administrations, relying heavily on public records. Thomas Kane, the chairman of the 9/11 Commission, served as a consultant. After much discussion, ABC executives and the producers toned down but did not eliminate entirely a scene that involved Clinton's national security advisor, Sandy Berger, declining to give the order to kill bin Laden, according to a person involved with the film. And Al Jazeera has aired what it called previously unshown footage of Al-Qaeda chief Osama bin Laden meeting with some of the 9/11 hijackers. The Arabic television station did not say how it obtained the video, which carried the logo of Az-Sahab, Al-Qaeda's media branch. Included in the video were the last will and testaments of two of the hijackers. Officials said that while the video was 5 years old, it is part of Al-Qaeda's ongoing propaganda campaign to make sure the organization stays in the world spotlight. As we approach, of course, the anniversary, the five-year anniversary of 9/11, we will have a special program on Coast to Coast Monday night. The leader of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, the new one, has urged his followers to kill at least one American in the next 2 weeks using a sniper rifle, explosive, or whatever the battle may require. This according to an audio tape. The Al Jazeera network, again, has identified the man on the tape as Abu Hamza al-Muharzi. He took command of the network's partner group in Iraq after an American airstrike killed its former leader, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. Diplomats at the United Nations were sent into disarray when the president of Iran has declared that he's coming to the United States to attend the General Assembly of the World Body on September 19th and that he's going to debate his country's nuclear program with President Bush, who is due to address the assembly that day as well. Now, the president has said, you're not going to debate him, but that's what the president of Iran plans to do. However, it is far from clear whether the Iranian president was serious, by the way, in his suggestion on whether he was merely trying to tweak the news of his American opponents. But it is interesting having the United Nations in this country and then having diplomats and government officials from countries that we are at odds with just coming into our country. That is weird. Of course, and again, they could just come through Mexico and get in that way. The owner of Data USA, a company that conducted political polls for the campaigns of President Bush, Senator Joe Lieberman, and other candidates, pleaded guilty to fraud for making up survey results and polls. Tracy Costin pleaded guilty to one count of conspiracy to commit wire fraud. According to a federal indictment, Costin told employees to alter poll data, and managers at the company told employees to, listen to this, talk to cats and dogs when instructing them to fabricate the surveys. Makes no sense. Speaking of animals, you know what? I'm convinced that mind and prayer power works. You know, we've been talking about the Kentucky Derby winner, Barbaro. Well, Barbaro, who was near death, now continues his slow recovery thanks to great vet work and you. Slow recovery from a broken leg suffered in the Preakness and the laminitis that developed following surgery. He may have the cast on his broken right hind leg changed again sometime in the next 2 weeks, depending on how his leg is healing. His left hind foot, afflicted with the laminitis, continues to improve gradually. It is a remarkable story, and I am convinced that power of prayer works. Well, caught in a scheduling squeeze, NASA has decided to try to launch the space shuttle Atlantis on Friday without replacing a troublesome electrical component. Friday is the last launch day available before the U.S. Space Agency runs into a scheduling conflict with a Russian space agency. In a moment, we will talk to our science advisor and head of the EnterpriseMission.com, Richard C. Hoagland, about this. I want to get Richard's take because they're going ahead now without replacing the electrical component. What does this mean? Well, Richard C. Hoagland on the line with us, head of the EnterpriseMission.com, our advisor. Richard, we were talking with you a couple of days ago, and we all expected this to be postponed indefinitely. They're going to go ahead with that troublesome electrical component still in the Atlantis.
You know, George, I've been at this a long time, decades. I was Walter Cronkite's science advisor. When I was growing up, I followed Mercury, Gemini. I got involved through CBS and Cronkite in Apollo. This is without doubt the most baffling NASA decision I have ever seen.
I want you to tell us, first of all, what this electrical component is and what it's supposed to do.
Okay. On the shuttle, in the orbiter, which is the thing with the wings that comes back, there are three gadgets called fuel cells. We've all heard about them for, propelling cars and using them in your home.
Sure.
NASA developed fuel cells decades ago to power spacecraft. They produce electrical power. Each of these fuel cells produces about 7,000 watts, about 7 kilowatts. So 3 times 7 is 21. That was enough to run the shuttle safely, all the systems, all the instruments, all the various control surfaces, et cetera, both going up in orbit and coming home. On Wednesday night, as they were doing the pre-check before they were going to fuel the big tanks with the 500,000 gallons of super cold liquid hydrogen and oxygen, when they started the fuel cell number one, they had a hiccup. They had a little blip of voltage spike that they shouldn't have. And as the hours progressed, as you know, they decided not to fuel the vehicle. They called an indefinite hold. They did 2 days, 48 hours of around-the-clock analysis and troubleshooting, and they came to the conclusion that there is a problem in a coolant pump in fuel cell number one. They have this little pump, little motor, which spins rapidly and pumps Freon around the fuel cell to keep it cold. Otherwise, the fuel cell has to be shut down in about 9 minutes if there's no cooling. So this pump is critical to keeping the fuel cell running for the power for the entire mission. Without three good fuel cells, you got to come home. If this were to quit, for instance, in orbit, they would have to come home even if they had two good fuel cells as backup power. So the worst-case scenario equipment-wise is that this thing will quit somewhere between launch and coming home. They will have to cut the mission short and come back early, and they may not be able to accomplish all the tasks that they're, basically trying to accomplish, the biggest one of which is to take up a 17.5-ton truss, which is a new solar power panel assembly, and attach it to the space station for more power for later adding to by other future missions.
Now, Richard, with this incredible concern for safety with Discovery, when that went up because of the foam problems before with Columbia. Now, in this particular case, I mean, it is a problem, and it's an obvious problem. Why go ahead with the launch?
This is what is the baffling part. I mean, I've been watching, like a hawk, all of the news conferences. I've got, internet connections to briefings. I've got video. It's like I'm there overlooking Wayne Hale's shoulder when these meetings are going on, and I get all the data that they've got, and I've been talking to some NASA veterans, and all the NASA veterans I'm talking to say this is nuts. This makes no sense at all. We are in a post-Challenger, post-Columbia world. Like we all talk about 9/11.
Yeah.
On Monday, we're going to celebrate the 9/11 thing, and the world has changed since before and after 9/11. Well, the world for NASA changed irrevocably post-Columbia, where we lost seven exquisite people. And everyone was supposed to think safety first, safety first, safety first. What they're going to do this morning, if things proceed, and there is a management meeting going on right now that began about 20 minutes ago and will end about 20 minutes from now at 45 after the hour. At that point, they will decide the final go, no go.
So that really hasn't been decided yet.
Well, technically, yes. Actually, no. The fix is in. They're going to go, barring some amazing thing that's happened, they're going to go. At which point they will begin chilling down this huge tank with these 500,000 gallons of super cold fuels, and then they will begin putting the fuel in these tanks, and then at 11:40 tomorrow morning Eastern Time, they will launch. The decision all rests on this little pump, which is a three-phase pump. In other words, it has a little electric motor, an AC motor, alternating current motor, that runs on three phases. 2 days ago, one of those phases quit. And so it's operating now on two phases. If another phase of this motor were to burn out or something were to happen, the motor would stop. The coolant of the fuel cell would stop. The fuel cell itself would then have to be shut down within 9 minutes or it explodes. Actually, it gets very hot and bad things happen, so they shut it off. Then you're on two fuel cells and you got to come home. So what we have here is a kind of a comparison between a game of poker and a game of Russian roulette.
Now, let me ask you, if this were to have had occurred a couple years ago, would they have scrubbed the launch?
Yes.
Yeah, I think so, too.
We seem to have what's called go fever. And there are people like Bill Harwood, who is the seasoned CBS science guy, for CBS News. He asked the pointed question of William Hale this afternoon. He said, Wayne Hale, I'm sorry. He said, from an outside observer, he said, it looks like this is being pushed by what's called schedule pressure. The president in 2004 said to the nation, we're going to retire the shuttle fleet, completely retire it in 2010. They have a lot of assembly work to do to complete the space station between now and 2010. So it really looks like they're, as on previous missions, remember how we had some questions about some decisions on the last mission?
Mm-hmm.
Where they had a RCS control thruster problem, and they decided to launch anyway?
Sure.
Well, this is much more serious. You have backups to all those thrusters. If one of those thrusters went out, you've got all kinds of workarounds. You've got, A, B, C. Here, if one more phase of this little motor goes out, we lose the fuel cell. If we lose the fuel cell, we lose the mission. We lose the mission in terms of the full duration. Now, one of the things that's up in the air tonight is, do we lose the space station? In other words, is this a rolling the dice, mixing my game metaphors here madly, or is it poker where you basically bet your entire hand, and the hand in this case is the entire manned U.S. space program for the next 5 to 8 years? Because if this mission becomes a cropper in orbit, let's say we launch successfully, and it takes them 3 days to rendezvous with the station. You know that.
Yeah.
Okay. During those 3 days, suppose fuel cell number one's little pump quits.
They have to come back.
And they have to come back. Do they have to come back right away? Or can they get to the station, unload the truss, which is critical for every future flight? In other words, this is like building a bridge where if you don't have a key component in place, you don't have a bridge.
Yeah.
You can't go to your next mission because this mission was the one that was supposed to put that truss up. Well, people will be saying, some of them were following this out there in the audience, they'll say, well, you just bring the truss home and you put it up on the next mission.
And apparently the International Space Station is only half built. Yeah, I thought it was further along.
No. That's because of the problems with Columbia. We are way behind because of the serious problems with killing seven people in Columbia and all the things NASA was supposed to learn. Now, here's the really problematic area. If they have to come home and they haven't got to the space station and the truss is in the payload bay, it's a 17.5-ton dead weight, right? Question, can Atlantis be landed as a glider with that truss still in the payload bay? Can it be landed safely?
Well, that is a great question.
Now, this is why
that's incredible weight, Richard.
Oh, yeah, 17.5 tons. Now, I did some checking. And remember back when Columbia happened and Sean O'Keefe, who was then administrator, said, oops, We can't go and resupply Hubble, and we can't bring the Hubble home as had been planned because its weight will compromise shuttle safety landing. I went and looked up the specs. The Hubble spacecraft weighs 24,500 pounds. This truss weighs 36,000 pounds. So if you couldn't land with Hubble, you can't land with this truss.
They'd have to jettison it.
Which means you basically jettison it in the high seas, which is Earth orbit. It never gets to the station. It reenters wildly somewhere over the God knows what part of the ocean or some continent.
I hope it doesn't hit some city.
That's another problem. But the main problem is you're dead in the water for the space station. You literally cannot complete it until you build another truss, and that took years. So they are rolling, my friend, the entire manned space program on this little pump that they don't want to change out because it would interrupt the schedule.
Now let me ask you a technical question. Something happens to my car. I bring it into the shop. They put a part on, or they get one Federal Expressed, and then I drive away the next day, Richard. Why can't we replace the cell?
We can replace the cell, but it takes time. If they do it on the pad, which they went through some procedures, it takes them probably 11, 12 days. They would miss this two-day window.
Why does it take so long? Can't you just get a new fuel cell and just go put it in?
Well, the problem is you've got the truss in the payload bay. This is under the floorboards in the back of the shuttle. So you've got to get past the airlock, which is in there for docking with the station. You've got to get past the truss, which is sitting in there. You have to have ground support equipment to open those payload bay doors, which, of course, are not meant to be opened in 1G. So they have to have, you know, hydraulic assist to open them and hold them open against gravity. The fuel cell itself weighs about 255 pounds. It's about 2 feet long, 1 foot wide, 18 inches deep. It's a heavy mother. And getting it out of there, past the other wiring and the other pumps and the other valves and lines and all that, is a delicate, tricky procedure. And some engineers were worried that they would do more damage inadvertently in that upright gravity position than if they did it back in the orbital processing facility where the shuttle is lying flat and you don't have anything in the way and you got all the time in the world, et cetera, et cetera. So it's not exactly like replacing something on your car.
And the other problem, and just so people understand why there's a big rush here, the Russians are going to go up there and they're going to dock with the ISS, which means we can't, right?
We have a kind of a traffic jam because there are mission rules that say that you can't have Soyuz and Atlantis docked simultaneously. There are good reasons for that, sound reasons. And remember, one of our guys, if you want to look at it parochially, is going to be coming home on that Soyuz. So you don't want to be landing in the dark and compromising the safety of the returning, you know, ISIS crew, Expedition 13. So, I mean, we're one big family on this. It's not like us and the Russians. This is a joint decision. So this is a very complicated thing made much more complicated by this press to get this mission up there and get this truss attached. Now, here's where we come to Russian roulette. I don't think this problem with the motor, George, and I'm the only one outside NASA I've seen say this except for some of the people I talk to on the phone who won't go public. I don't think this motor problem is the motor. This motor is 30 years old. It was built back in 1976. It has not been tested. It hasn't been run for 7 years in this fuel cell. The last time this fuel cell flew was on a mission called STS-93.
Gee.
Atlantis itself has not been flying since October of 2002. That's almost
4 years.
So when they started the fuel cell up the other night, I think the vibrations triggered the dreaded, remember the whiskers?
Yep.
In these electronics, these 30-year-old electronics? I think this bird in those aging black boxes all through the shuttle is filled with whiskers growing on the tin solder. And this is a time bomb waiting to happen, because what could happen when you trigger this launch? You have vibrations like you can't imagine, you know, 5 Gs, 6 million pounds of thrust, almost 7 million pounds of thrust between the solid rocket boosters and the liquid fuel shuttle main engines. And this thing is going up. You got vibrations, incredible transients, back and forth shaking, vibration. Imagine those whiskers touching other critical components, causing other shorts in systems all over the shuttle, or floating around in zero G when you get into orbit and causing shorts. They can't understand why they have a short in this motor when it was just sitting there quietly on a shelf for 7 years.
Well, we're going to find out very shortly whether the shuttle is going to go or not. Richard says they plan to, and NASA says they plan to. Well, we'll find out. The Richard C. Hoagland's website, enterprisemission.com. Those of you who have emailed me, you're interested in his Joshua Tree event in October. There's full information there on Richard's homepage. We'll be right back. That's right. We're going to have full moon open lines for you now this hour. And then next hour, he joins us, Robert Young Pelton, as we talk about these mercenaries, these people who kill for cash. And that'll be next on Coast to Coast AM. We'll be back. Okay, full moon open lines. Let us begin by going east of the Rockies. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, George. This is Alan from Chatham, New York.
Hey, Adam. Welcome to the program.
Oh, actually, it's Alan. Sorry, I'm on a cell phone, so I might
okay,
be a little bit
Okay, sure. Okay, Alan.
But anyway, I've got a quick comment and then a quick question.
Sure.
I just heard that interview with Richard C. Hoagland. That guy is, I've been a big fan of his for a while, and I got to encourage a lot of people out there to go to Coast AM and link up to enterprisemission.com and look at some of his research. Just a quick thing to bring up as a quick point of interest is that on every 19.5 degree latitude, on every planetary body in the system, including the sun, there's an interesting phenomenon like sunspots or the Great Red Spot,
right,
Jupiter or Hawaii. But anyway, to my quick question, I was watching, I think, PAX Television Network or something, and they had Story Musgrave, who is NASA astronaut. He was on the sixth shuttle flight.
Mm-hmm.
He repaired the Hubble Space Telescope. And he said that he saw, like, something that resembled a simple worm-like organism floating outside the International Space Station. And then so I've done incredible research on the Internet trying to find anything about this, and the closest I find is what seems like disinformation saying that he saw, like, a part of the apparatus of the space station.
Right.
I mean, the guy knows what he's seeing. So I was wondering if you ever heard anything about that.
No, I heard the same thing you did, and also did the same kind of search and could never get any corroboration on it. All I could simply say is that, you know, it was a shuttle part or something. I think it was part of a tether that they tried to explain. And
but the thing is, I mean, it just strikes me as, I mean, I'm a big fan of evolution, too. I mean, it's an obvious proven thing. I mean, look what we did to dogs. It kind of proves evolution.
Right.
But they could somehow be related to rods. Somehow, I mean, because these things will be...
Well, who knows? That's a great idea. That is just as good as anything I've heard.
I mean, it kind of makes sense to me. I don't know if they'd be driven by plasma propulsion or something, or maybe they could be even cigar-shaped UFO-type things. But anyway, that's it for me. I'll just open up the lines for other
people.
Okay,
and I agree with you about Richard C. Hoagland. The guy is absolutely brilliant. You know, he's got incredible theories, and he makes things very, very interesting and fun. But when he gets right down to it, when he gets into the nitty-gritty of hard science, he does make you think. And I think he's right on with the space shuttle in this particular case. You know, in the old days, birds would fly by and they'd stop a launch, for crying out loud. You know, and here a fuel cell appears to be faulty. It's erratic. And they're going to go ahead with this. It just doesn't make sense. You know, this is shades of the horrible Columbia disaster, when, you know, they spotted a little bit of foam broken away, but they didn't think it was a big deal. This could be a big deal. There's no reason to do this. So if you have to wait another month, you wait another month. So be it. Wildcard Line, you're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Greetings. This is Elaine from Portland.
Hello, Elaine.
Hey, I've got an interesting question. And thinking about this wonderful character known as JC, our regular caller.
He pops in every once in a while.
There's a heck of a debate on the net, and now I'm on the fence, whether he is really, truly a preacher guy out there somewhere in the world, or if he's just an Andy Kaufman-like comedian who hasn't revealed himself.
Who knows?
You know,
who knows? I don't know. I have no idea. You know, he started calling art a couple of years ago.
Actually, no. Back in 1996, I have the MP3s.
Okay, good. And, you know, he pops in and pops out. He calls Art. He calls me. He called Ian once. I have no idea who the guy is. I don't know if he's if he's an actor, if he's a fraud, or if the guy is really a, you know, a religious fanatic doing what he does.
Here's what really gets me. If he's really a great preacher or whatever and has a great new revelation, I have an open question to J.C. Hey, J.C., how come the new revelation cannot be found in any Christian bookstore?
You know, you got to call in. You know what? If we can ever get the guy, you know, he might be an interesting guest for an entire hour.
Yeah, let's see if he can handle it. I have a suggestion for you.
Yeah.
Next time you're dealing with a guy and he starts doing that interesting, you know, your goon stuff.
Yeah.
Challenge him. He is in so favor of the great American government and how flawless it is. Challenge him to call the FBI to investigate you. The flawless American government could possibly not miss all the clues he has about you.
Thanks.
Challenge him to call the FBI.
I agree. Thanks. Yeah,
old
JC thinks I put hits on people if I don't like them. Unbelievable. Steve, what are you laughing at me? West of the Rockies, you're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, this is Jose with from Hayward, California.
Hey, welcome to the show.
How you doing tonight?
Good.
Also, I just had a question about last night's guest. Did he say the reptilians were descended from dinosaurs?
That was John Rhodes. He was our first guest. And no, I don't think he did. He believes that these reptilians have been part of the planet for a long time. I mean, part of his theory was it's possible that they might have been genetically altered a long time ago, but he thinks that they're earthbound. But I don't think from dinosaurs.
Oh, that's what I was thinking. Maybe they were descended from dinosaurs and, you know, when
they just evolved.
Yeah, the meteor just came down, they went underground and evolved.
Maybe. I'd like to see one of these creatures, wouldn't you?
Oh, that'd be interesting.
From a distance, of course.
Great. Have a good night.
All right. Thanks. Appreciate the call. Full Moon Open Lines. Next up, Wild Card Line. You're on Coast to Coast. It's your turn. Hi there.
Hey, George. How are you doing?
I'm well. Thank you.
This is Don. I'm calling from Tracy, California.
Yeah.
Hey, listen, I agree with what Mr. Hogan says about the shuttle, and I really think that they should cancel this mission. I mean, think about it. Would you put an old fuel pump on a new engine, you know, in your car?
Nope. I sure would not.
If it's that much at stake, you know, then they shouldn't take any chances at all. And I think that we should email or do something and just voice our opinion.
I wonder what the astronauts, who are tough, good Americans, are thinking tonight. You know, you would hope that the people at NASA, and there are a lot of good workers there, but you would hope that they would, you know, think first of the safety of the astronauts. And if we know going in that there's a potential problem, there's no rush here. This is not the end of the planet. They're not going up there to try to push an asteroid out of the way. It's not one of those must missions. So if we have to wait a month, fix the problem. Would you go on a long-distance trip if you knew you had air leaking out of a tire? Heck no. You'd get it replaced. You'd get it fixed. You wouldn't say, well, I'll just go as far as I can and see what happens. Maybe it'll hold up. You can't do that. And with this space shuttle, as Richard said, it hasn't been up in 4 years. You know, who knows what's going to rattle when that thing gets going. East of the Rockies, you're up on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi.
Yeah, welcome.
Hi, this is Celeste from Pittsburgh.
Celeste, what's on your mind?
Hi, I have a story about an out-of-body experience that I had about in 2000.
All right, what happened?
I was in a car accident, and I got knocked out. And the next thing that I knew, I was floating up into the air and could see my body. And I didn't feel anything. I didn't feel happy. I didn't feel sad. I didn't feel pain. I felt nothing. And the next thing I knew, I heard somebody saying to me, "Do you want to go back?" And I said, "Yes." And I felt my body rushing. I felt myself rushing back into my body. And it was the weirdest thing that I ever experienced in my entire life because I didn't feel anything. There was no feeling whatsoever. It was totally numb. No feelings of my mind or anything. It was just the weirdest thing I ever experienced in my life.
Celeste, were you aware then, when you came back into your body, were you aware that you were in that other dimension, basically, that other plane of existence?
It was definitely something. I don't know what... Everyone says that I was dreaming. I know that I wasn't dreaming. I dream every night. I know what that is. This was not a dream.
And there was no pain, nothing, when you came back in?
No, there... Well, when I came back to my body, yes, there was definitely pain. But when I left it, I felt nothing. It was just...
Oh, no, you won't. But when you came back then, you felt all the horrible feelings of being someone who was injured pretty badly. What happened to you in the accident, if we can ask here?
Well, unfortunately, it was really stupid. I was hanging out of a sunroof.
Hanging out of a sunroof?
Yes. My friend was doing, we went to this place called 13 Bends. It's supposed to be haunted.
Okay.
And you're supposed to hear all these weird things. And at first, we were driving slow, and then he started driving really fast, and it was fun, like, at first,
and you
took a bend going 80 and didn't make it, and I got knocked out by a tree branch.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
You're standing up there waving to nobody, right? Just hooting and hollering.
Yeah.
And as he does...
It was fun at first, yeah.
You hit a tree branch at 80 miles an hour?
With my head, yeah. I went down onto the top of the car and hit the top of my head off of a tree branch, yes, and got knocked out.
Now... Did you stay in the car, or did your body get tossed out?
No, I was, when I woke up, when I came back to, I was looking through the windshield. My body had went over and was looking through into the inside of the car.
Girl, you're lucky you're alive.
Trust me, I know this.
Okay, thanks. Appreciate that. What a story. First time caller line. You're on the air on Full Moon Open Lines. Hi there.
Good morning, George.
Hi.
This is Al. I was listening with interest to Mr. Hoagland, and I don't know if he mentioned that in 1997, the space shuttle Columbia was actually ordered back from 4 days on orbit due to a defective fuel cell. The reason given was that the fault in the fuel cell meant that the supercold liquid hydrogen and oxygen it uses to generate electricity might overheat and mix, causing a disastrous explosion. And they brought it back early because of a defective fuel cell.
So there's a precedent there, and they're going ahead with a potential danger when 9 years ago then or so.
1997.
They didn't do that. They fixed that. They pulled back. They were concerned.
Yeah, they brought it back, and they brought it back because of the safety. Obviously, they felt that there would be an explosion.
My
God. And, of course, the thing is that it was the Columbia.
Yeah, how ironic. Hey, thanks for that. I know Richard's aware of it. He didn't cite that specifically, and he does tell us right now that the countdown has resumed. The fueling is about ready to begin. Wildcard Line, you're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Good morning, George. My name is Dan, calling from Missouri.
Hey, Dan.
Reason I called this morning, some coworkers and I were discussing spirits and the afterlife. A paramedic and work at a hospital. We've got a resident ghost or spirit or whatever of a. We're assuming it's a little boy that passed away in the hospital. He's been around for 10 or 12 years, and people have seen him. And strange things happen around the hospital from time to time. And the discussion we were having was whether spirits are just residual and repetitive events that continue to occur after somebody passes away, or if it's actually something sentient. Because with this, I mean, he's kind of playful. You'll see feet go by under a door, but then nobody will be out there. There are some doctors that he occasionally will play pranks on, turning lights on and off, or TVs on and off, things like that. And it's never anything malicious, and we were just discussing that. The reason it came up was we were watching some supernatural shows on television late night, and if it is something that is left over after a traumatic event or whatever, wouldn't ambulances or hospital emergency rooms be one of those most heavily populated? You know,
in some cases, you know, if the spirit realizes that it's gone, it might not hang around. And you are correct. You would assume that where there are a lot of deaths, there could be a lot of ghosts and spirits. But I think it all depends on that particular entity. I mean, we know for a fact that Gettysburg, you know, during the Civil War era, where thousands of men died, people have seen incredible ghost stories there. I mean, strange things. Now, in this particular case, you know, it's very possible that it's repetitive. The little boy keeps coming back over and over again, maybe even at a certain time. But it sounds like he's not going to leave.
No, no, and you know, it's to the point now where I don't think anybody would even want him to.
No, you'd miss him, wouldn't you?
Right. It's interesting. Like I said, he seems to be drawn to some people more than others. He'll show up or walk by the door more when some people are there than others.
Does he try to communicate with people?
Haven't ever had anything like that. But there was a doctor. The physicians stay in a room where supposedly, and this did, like I said, the records have been kind of lost in antiquity as far as who it actually was. But there's a certain room where the doctors stay, and some doctors will have lights turned on, their bedclothes rumpled, TVs will go on and off while they're in there. And there are a few paramedics that he'll walk by the door, and you'll see feet standing under the door, but when you walk over and open the door, nobody's there. And some people, he does that more often than not, too.
That's something. You got a great story there. Hey, thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate you being part of the program. East of the Rockies, welcome to Coast to Coast. Hi.
Hi, my name's Larry here. Can you hear me?
Yes, Larry, loud and clear.
Great. I'm calling from upstate New York, and I just want to tell you something very strange has been going on with me lately. I can pick out aces out of a deck of cards.
We're going to Vegas with you, Larry.
Well, it doesn't work when I gamble. I've tried. It's always a disappointment. But when I'm just shuffling a deck of cards, I can pull an ace out, like, all the time.
How many aces are in this deck of cards, Larry?
Right, that's something to look at. But it's a regular deck of cards, George, just a regular deck.
I mean, all the time you do this?
Consistently, I can pluck out aces.
Okay, so there's, let's see, 52 cards in a deck.
Right.
We don't call it the Joker or the wild card or anything like that. So 52 cards, four aces. That means your odds of pulling out an ace are 1 in 13. Does that
make
sense?
That's correct. Yeah. Very good. Very good, George.
Right. 1 in 13. And you do it, I bet, much higher than that.
Much higher. What I do also is I go through 20. I pluck 26 cards, and I'll always have 3 or 4. Sometimes, usually 3 or 4, sometimes 2, and very rarely will I get less than 2 in half the deck.
Yet, you say when you try to gamble with this gift, it doesn't work.
Doesn't seem to work. I can't pick other things. I haven't been able to figure out how to turn a profit on this.
Yeah. Do you have to be the one to physically touch the cards, or can you just make it happen by thinking and somebody else would do it?
I've had other people shuffle the deck and hand it to me, but I haven't been able to let someone else pick a card or be the one to choose.
Couldn't
so I have to hold the deck.
See, but you can't do that in Vegas. That's why you're not winning.
Right. They don't let me shuffle the cards.
No. No, I don't think they will.
Right.
Okay, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. No, you touch those cards in Vegas, you're going to lose a finger, probably. Wild card line, you're on the air. Hi.
Hi.
Hello.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
Earlier this year, I was attending school in upstate New York, and inside my dorm room, I didn't get very good reception, so I got in the habit of listening to the program out of my truck.
Okay.
And one of the funny things was I was always worried about a security guard coming and knocking on my window, wondering what I was doing. Well, one night earlier this year, you had on an individual that had on about he could contact dead people through mirrors.
Right.
Crying.
Exactly.
I was listening to that program, and I was thinking about it, and I fell asleep. Well, I woke up maybe about an hour later, and there was a face in the window looking back at me. And I immediately was embarrassed. I was like, oh, the security guard caught me. And then I realized that it was just a face. There was no body.
Oh, my.
And it was looking at me intently. And see, the thing is, it was very silvery, the way it looked.
Was it an evil-looking face or just a normal face?
It wasn't evil, but it looked supernatural.
Man, I'd hate to wake up and see one of those things looking down on me. I'll be back in a moment. License to Kill. That's the name of the topic tonight on Coast to Coast AM.